SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Race fans, Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevepick.com. You know, my mother, bless her, my mother said, you should go to law school. And I scoffed. I said, no, that's not, I don't know. Well, may have taken, may have taken, I don't know, when did I graduate? 82. May have taken 40 years, but she was right. There's obviously, there's gold in them thar hills. If you're trying to, trying to bring some levity to what was another day of just other shoes falling. I don't know. Were they other shoes or were they new shoes? Bowling shoes, rented shoes. With all these bowling alleys closing, by the way, what are they going to do with all those shoes? Just a random thought. The odyssey involving Linda Rice came not even to a, it's not even a conclusion yesterday. This was the first of several legal issues, as it were. The New York Gaming Commission that has investigated and has been handling or dealing with this unusual issue that ended up affecting quite a few people in the NYRA racing office and clocker stand and Linda Rice. And after the delayed investigation and 10-day, however long it was, hearing, the commission unanimously approved a penalty of a $50,000 fine and a 3-year revocation of her license. And that's a minimum. That doesn't there's no guarantee in the way this is structured and worded that when she reapplies they will grant her her license back. And, of course, this involved garnering entry information from the racing office. And, then deciding what races to participate in. A unfair advantage without, without discussion. It's not. There isn't room for debate. And people are saying, "Oh, well, the racing office hustles people." That's not what this is. That's not what this is at all. It's really not comparable. So that was the first of several things that came to pass yesterday. Not long after that news broke, as the Gaming Commission was handling a variety of agenda of business issues, the New York Racing Association. And let's make a distinction, and I'll let Alan Foreman, who will join us in 10 minutes. I can't go 3 days without an Alan Foreman visit. Alan will reiterate what I tweeted last night, late yesterday afternoon, because as the news that NYRA was issuing a, you know, a temporary suspension of Bob Baffert and any, you know, any connection to his stable, meaning, you know, if horses were going to be sent to New York to, typically the Terra Nova barn looks after Baffert horses when they come to town, and anybody employed by, so there's no, you know, there's no way that running a horse in a different name, none of that. And NYRA will monitor and make a further determination as things play out on the Medina Spirit side, the Kentucky investigation. And the distinction I tried to make yesterday, because people immediately made, you know, kind of assumptions about these two things. NYRA did this, NYRA did, there's a distinct difference. The New York Racing Association is a racetrack operator. The New York Gaming Commission is a regulator that administers, that manages the rules and oversees the legalities of, you know, not just racing, but anything gambling related in New York State. One time it was very horse racing centric, and then they kind of reoriented. It was the Racing and Wagering Board, and now it's the Gaming Commission with the advent of casinos. So the Gaming Commission is not NYRA, and NYRA is not the Gaming Commission. So, and if you want a further, if you want to go up in the steward stand, I mean, that even that is, you know, has got a different, an unusual, you know, setup with one from the Jockey Club, one from the Gaming Commission, one from NYRA. So when people say, oh, the NYRA stewards, well, it's not, there's a NYRA steward, there's one in the stand from the Jockey Club, and there's one from the commission. So just some distinctions just to help you understand. So this is ostensibly a house rule that is being instituted regarding Baffert, and it's temporary. They'll make further determinations. And they, you know, they quoted or were, you know, they termed the, you know, integrity of the sport and to protect the betting public and fans and racing participants. You know, they said the right things. We'll let Alan Foreman, who's going to join us at 9:15, we'll let Alan explain how these work. I think we last addressed one of these really with the Hollendorfer. It's not dissimilar to what transpired with Stronach and Stronach Group and Jerry Hollendorfer. The Linda Rice thing is different, and we'll let Alan help you on that front. I've got a couple of other, you know, sort of corollaries to the testing discussions and the topics that came up last week that I do want Alan to address. In fact, some people brought up a very good question about why it's possible to have tests done last week on Medina Spirit Concert Tour and Beautiful Gift, you know, have repeated tests and screenings and have them, you know, done and returned you know, literally in 24-hour turnarounds. And yet, when split samples and when there's, you know, testing of samples coming out of victories and so forth, why it takes 3 weeks? Why is there this, you know, how is it possible that they got all those tests done last week and, you know, we sit and wait and wonder the other scenario? So I thought that that's a question worth addressing. So I'll throw that one at Alan as well. There were two West Coast topics that fall into this arena that came out yesterday as well. Ron McAnally, who I don't think anybody can remember when he's had any issue when it came to a test. The presence of a cannabinoid, CBD, essentially. And, you know, there's going to be plenty of these, more of these. And Giovanni Franco, readily acknowledged that he had it, you know, on his body and on his, you know, on his hands and so forth. And so it doesn't, you know, it's not a shock that you could get a contamination like this. And I'm sure it's going to be handled, you know, appropriately. But this is something I'm going to guess that jurisdictions are going to have to deal with, because to some degree there's no, you know, nobody's ever really worried about this, because why would you? But now, you know, there's a way to transfer this, and so I'm going to ask Alan about this one too. It's funny, the people who constantly, you know, say, oh, there's no such thing as cross-contamination, they immediately said, oh, well, this has got to be a cross-contamination. Yeah. There was also a methocarbamol presence for Richard Mandela. So, I'll save all that for Alan. There's only so much of this, you know. I don't know how many different ways you can discuss these, but it's important. It doesn't. It's not going away. A few things too before Alan joins us. Timonium, very good day yesterday. And as kind of anticipated, including $1.5 million quality road colt, excuse me, that West Point signed for. So we'll see how they're going to divvy that up. Eddie Woods, who had a big day. All these sales, Eddie Woods is going to have big days. He also sold a $700,000 colt. So we're going to talk to Jessica Martini in this hour. We'll let Jess catch you up. I watched a little bit of the sale. I didn't get to watch too much, but it sure looked like there was a nice wide middle range in the, you know, the 100,000 to 300,000, 350 range. You know, beneath the top sellers, there was $1.5 million. The Malibu Moon Colt for 700 was the second highest price. The Lowe's, Bob and Luana Lowe, they bought the highest price filly, a Classic Empire. I had the stream on, actually, and I did hear that one. That was a Broman product. It actually comes with a name too, Classy Edition. So, Jessica Martini of the TDN will join us, and we'll get some of the stories behind the sales. We're going to talk to Jonathan Hardoon, and you heard me mention yesterday and spend a couple of minutes paying tribute to Len Ragazin, who passed away at 92, not all that far away, really, living in Vermont these last several years. And I guess he had, been suffering some Alzheimer's symptoms and so forth the last several years. So I don't know how many of his, you know, longtime associates were in close contact. I'm hoping to get Len Friedman tomorrow. But Cardoon, familiar to so many of you, Sheets users, no Jonathan. He's going to join us at about 10:15 after Jessica, and we'll let him talk. I think he'll probably talk about the business side and the figures and what, you know, what Len's legacy is on that front, and we'll get Len Friedman to talk quite a bit about, you know, about Len Ragusan, the person, the man. They were partners from early on, and the two Lens helped him, you know, the foundation I mentioned yesterday. So I was not going to let Len Ragusan's passing go, you know, just with a casual mention. Too important not to hear more about him. We're going to talk to John Fratkin. We're going to get the backstory, if you hadn't read about it, and how pandemic helped he and Diane, his wife, how they were able to enjoy the fruits of their breeding operation, which has been very successful for a small, and John will explain it, small commercial breeder with just, you know, a couple of mares at any one time, and how, you know, it evolved and how amazingly successful they've been with a very limited broodmare band. And the story of Rombauer ends up being really kind of fun, and story is gonna continue on. So we'll talk to John, and looking forward to that. I think we're gonna get we should have at least one trainer from the weekend in, depending on how busy they are at the sale and on the sales grounds, and we'll get Popo in later. Don't forget, it's opening night at Canterbury, and in fact, let me want to pull up the I'll pull up the quick sheet so I have it in front of me, and they got a nice card, nice way to start the season. So we'll probably look at a race or two. The ultra low pick five starts in race races 5 through 9 tonight. And big fields. This is I was going to look at it later after the show, but this looks like this will be pretty taxing. It looks like 12 by 9 by 10 by 11 by 12. So eat your Wheaties. I had a bowl of Wheaties this morning, actually. Take a sip of coffee. There we go. Alan Foreman's going to join us here, and Casey reaching out. So we'll start with Alan. And I'm not going to launch into anything else, really, until he joins us. So we also get to, since Alan's coming back, surprising. I really didn't expect to have Alan back here so quickly after two visits last week. But it's the... It's rare that we're in May and guest of the year is already decided. Because I think Alan's, this will be like the fifth or sixth time Alan's been on in less than 5 months. So, any sign of Alan, Case? No, not yet. All right. Well. I'll give it a second then. All right. He is on. Okay. Alan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
All right, there we go. Alan, the news yesterday, you know, we knew at some point the Linda Rice story was going to come to a head and there would be a gaming commission decision, and then came this Baffert news and then some West Coast CHRB items. Let's take these chronologically and start with the Linda Rice case and talk about, you know, this kind of a decision and what you know, what it means to, you know, for her career and what the recourses are.
At the outset, let me say that I've known Linda for over 20 years. I've worked with Linda. She's not only a great horse trainer who comes from a well-respected family, her father, Clyde Rice. And Linda's not only a great trainer, but she's given up her time for Backstretch Causes, the scholarship program that NYFA administers. So I have the highest respect for Linda, and this just really just saddens me to no end. I think you described earlier that Linda was accused of being engaged in conduct with NYRA employees that amounted to a bribe for inside information that allowed Linda to have an advantage over horses that she entered in NYRA races over a period of time. While I was not involved in any way, shape, or form in the case, I think that it's important to understand that, you know, NYRA was in the early 2000s, around 2004, was the subject of a criminal investigation. There was a money laundering scheme that had taken place at the NYRA tracks. NYRA was investigated by the United States Attorney's Office. There were other issues involving not current NYRA management or the management before. When Charlie Hayward and Steve Dunker came in, it was to clean things up. It was a prior administration. But they were referred for potential criminal prosecution to the United States Attorney's Office, which resulted in a deferred prosecution and the appointment of a monitor for a period of time. And NYRA has, over the years, been required essentially to self-report any conduct that might be might damage the integrity of the business, integrity of the sport, or any improper conduct. And so when this scheme was discovered, it's my understanding that it was reported to the Queens County District Attorney for potential criminal action, and the Queens County District Attorney, which really wasn't capable of investigating these kinds of matters, I believe felt that this was within the purview of the New York Gaming Commission, decided not to prosecute and referred it back for any regulatory disciplinary action. And in the interim between that time and Linda's hearing, at least one other individual who was involved in the scheme and who was found in violation was given a 10-year suspension. So when Linda's case came before the commission and hearing officer, I guess there was the expectation among some that Linda would get the same penalty. Now, Linda went through a lengthy hearing. I think it took 10 days, and it was widely reported. And I have not seen the hearing officer's report. This was just announced yesterday, but he found that Linda had engaged in conduct that damaged the integrity of the sport and gave her a $50,000 fine and a revocation of her license for a minimum of 3 years. Linda will have 30 days from yesterday to determine and to whether she wants to file an appeal of that decision. You know, the history of the Gaming Commission recently is that if you file an appeal, they can come back with a tougher penalty, and they've done that. So she's going to have to weigh that, and she's going to have to weigh the fact that there is a substantial body of evidence in a record over 7 to 10 days to determine whether or not what their legal argument is going to be, which is this arbitrary and capricious? Is there no basis upon which the hearing officer could have reached his decision? These appeals take a long time in New York. They are not expeditiously heard and resolved, although she could seek a temporary restraining order, meaning or request a stay from the Gaming Commission. She could immediately request a stay if she appeals, and the Gaming Commission would have to determine whether they will allow her to continue to train pending the resolution of her case, or will they refuse to grant her a stay, in which case she would have to go into court and ask the court to impose a stay under the argument that she will be irreparably harmed if she should somehow be able to demonstrate to a court that this decision was not based on the record, was arbitrary, whatever the legal standard is. Her argument is going to be that she was irreparably harmed. She can't get back what she's lost, including her reputation. So therefore, there should be a timeout to let her prosecute her appeal. And that's what the next step will be. And hypothetically, if the court were not to grant a stay and the Gaming Commission were not to grant the stay and the penalty goes into effect, even while Linda prosecutes her appeal, if she does so, she will not be permitted to race, not only in New York, but because of the rules of reciprocity, and I think I described them last week, she will not be able to participate in racing at any other racetrack in the United States. So essentially, she will have to leave the business until either there's a resolution of her case or until she serves her suspension or the revocation minimum of 3 years, or she is somehow reinstated. And it's not hard to figure out what that means insofar as her business is concerned. It's really a sad situation.
It's interesting that you brought up the Dutrow period which was, you want to talk about arbitrary. There was no parameter. There wasn't even a specific charge when that penalty was invoked. And you mentioned the other suspension, which I'm going to assume you mean Mike Gonzalez, the jock agent.
Yeah.
And there was speculation. Some people thought that, in fact, that she would get more than three. And I'm sure she's, most troubled by or frustrated or worried about, a 3 year. It's one of these cases that is so unique, really, Alan. I mean, I think to most people's memory, there's nothing really to compare it to.
I don't think there is. Let me say this about Dutrow for comparative purposes. Dutrow was caught with syringes, and he had in his desk drawer, I think he had a positive test for butorphanol, which is a therapeutic medication. But he received a penalty from the stewards. His penalty was upheld, but he appealed it. And during the course of the appeal, and remember, Dutrow was the face of the industry back then. He was the highest profile trainer. I mean, we went through this whole public discussion about steroids in horse racing, because steroids in sports was the issue at the time. What were we, back in 2008, 2009, 2010. And Dutrow was very brash, and he, bragged about the fact that he used steroids. And then there was the failure of Big Brown with the biggest race, quite frankly, of all, because it was the potential Triple Crown, and the discussion didn't stop. But he filed his appeal, and the head of the Association of Racing Commissioners International wrote a letter to the Gaming Commission and said, hey, folks, are you taking into consideration the fact that this trainer has a long history of medication violations, and you haven't really taken a hold of that? And so because he had appealed and because the case was still open, the Gaming Commission took a look at that and said, you know what, you're right. And so they imposed an unprecedented 10-year suspension on Dutrow for his accumulation of violations. It wasn't that they found syringes and he had a positive test for butorphanol. It was a body of positive tests over a long period of time. And he was the poster child, and they delivered a message to the industry that it's not going to be tolerated. But that was the Gaming Commission that did that. It was not NYRA. It wasn't any other regulator. It wasn't any other racetrack. It was the Gaming Commission. And that and Dutrow challenged that, and that, you know, went through the court system and was upheld. He's now, 7 years into it? He sought reinstatement on several occasions. They've all been denied, and his suspension ends, I think, in 2023. I think he's got 2 more years. Context is important is what I'm trying to say, and you have to understand the underlying circumstances to understand decisions that have been made and why they've been made. Dutrow was the poster child, and I know we'll get into the Baffert situation, but with respect to Linda Rice, as you point out, you know, some people thought she was going to get 10 years. You know, she might be able to, or her lawyer may be able to argue, you know, we did better than what could have happened, but it's still a very, very serious and difficult penalty.
And before we merge into the NYRA's handling of Baffert, I want to, whether you consider it counter or just for balance, I do want to make a distinction about Rick Dutrow. The number of infractions that he had and the number that was always bandied around was like 64. The only problem with that number was that I believe 48 or 49 of them were for failure to have paperwork in the racing office, like papers, like full papers, smoking on the shed row, and a bunch of other absolute nothing. In reality, his record in terms of violations of actual, you know, overages and such was no worse than anybody else's that had been in the business for, you know, multiple decades. So a lot of it was trumped up, and a lot of it involved the headhunting of one individual, John Sabini, who was trying to become, you know, the drug czar of racing, sort of like the Indiana character. It was an absolute, you want to use the term witch hunt. They were looking for a scapegoat. The way Hollendorfer's been made a scapegoat, and we can shift the talk to Baffert. You know, people are going to adjudicate that themselves one direction or another. But the characterization of Rick Dutrow is very murky. It's not black and white.
Yeah, I mean, his record of medication violations did not involve what many would have considered at the time to be serious medication violations. But again, context is important. Those of us who are in the industry tend to understand this in a different light than the public may look at it. And this, you know, this has been a rough decade for us, where as the public probes more into our business and compares it to other sports, they begin to question whether we really take seriously those who violate the rules and regulations and threaten the integrity of the sport. And so some individuals become the face of the sport, and it always happens, or almost always happens, around Triple Crown time, because that's the one time when people who may not be as familiar with our sport show interest and ask questions, and we have a media that doesn't necessarily pay attention to us the rest of the year, who looks at it, and they look at it in the context of other sports and where we are today, and they draw conclusions. And you can see it in the media coverage in the last 2 weeks. It speaks to it. And public reaction, people that I talk to on the street all the time. It's one thing for us to be an insider, so to speak, and understand the business. It's different when you get outside that, and they don't know the difference. They don't know who regulates the sport. They don't know the difference between a racing commission and a racetrack and the way we're doing business. And some of it's even the media, when they talk about it, doesn't understand it. So it's a challenge for our sport. It's been our challenge. And that's why people are looking for some other way to kind of centralize the message, centralize the decision-making, and try to get us away from this, what to them appears to be just total industry dysfunction.
Well, on that topic, in that vein, your thoughts about what NYRA decided to do yesterday. There was apparently, you know, a lot of internal discussion. Some people are wondering, oh, they did it conveniently because Medina Spirit lost. They wouldn't have done it if he won. But in fact, you know, the discussion was started in advance of Preakness. Some thoughts about, you know, what this constitutes, and you know what the value of it is, how other jurisdictions, how other racetrack operators might view it, etc.
Well, Steve, I'm not privy to any inside sure. information on NYRA's deliberations, their decision making, or otherwise. So let me discuss it in general terms. There has been this growing tension between the regulatory community and the racetracks. Clearly frustration among many in racing, and clearly the number of the racetracks, over what they believe has been a lack of appropriate regulatory oversight, particularly in the area of medication and safety and welfare. That was clear after the Arkansas Racing Commission came up with their convoluted decision involving two of the Baffert positive tests several months ago. It seemed to kind of set the stage for this. as I said on your show last week, the sport is regulated by the regulatory community, racing commissions. Racing is a state-sanctioned, state-regulated business, and the rules of racing and the enforcement of the rules of racing is done by racing commissions and not by racetracks. So in the case of the Kentucky Derby, and I've seen some reporting, even in the New York Times, that when Churchill Downs announced that it was barring Bob Baffert going forward, and that there is an investigation, and that if the positive test comes back, they will disqualify Bob's horse. Churchill Downs does not regulate the sport. Churchill Downs does not have the authority to disqualify Medina Spirit. If Medina Spirit is disqualified and if Bob Baffert is penalized, that is done by the Kentucky Racing Commission and not by Churchill Downs. And the reporting on that has been off. Churchill did it after the fact. Bob is, as I said, is not racing at Churchill, so it's more of a public relations gesture. But it did send a message, and I think it sent a message about their frustration with the regulatory process. The Strana Group only had a week to deal with this problem, and they determined, based on the law and their analysis of the law, that they probably would not be successful in barring either Bob Baffert or his horses from running on Preakness Day. and they didn't want to get into the litigation, and that would have been the story of the week instead of trying to focus on Preakness weekend. And so they chose not to take any action. They really didn't have much time to deal with it, and I think they felt they would not have been successful. In the meantime, for NYRA, they were probably faced with the same decision. There were those in the media and otherwise who were saying, well, NYRA, do something here because nobody else seems to be doing anything. And so NYRA has to look at it from a different lens. There's a body of case law in New York, and it's actually pretty much case law across the country, that racetracks have the common law right to exclude any patron they want for whatever reason, so long as it is not a decision based on race, color, creed, religion, those so-called civil rights. But when it comes to a licensee, NYRA doesn't, and TRACS do not have the common law right just to arbitrarily exclude a licensee. In other words, just tell Bob Baffert, you know what, we have a common law right to exclude you, we're going to exclude you. It doesn't work that way. The courts have found that NYRA is what's called a state actor. What courts will look to in these kinds of cases is what is the relationship between the state that is allowing racing to occur and regulates it and the private organization that runs the races. And there's a two-prong test. I'll give you a little legal lesson here. It's a two-prong test. One is called the nexus test, and that is the state so involved that the state is participating in making the decision to exclude? And courts have found with respect to NYRA that the nexus test is not met. It doesn't happen, that the state doesn't get involved when NYRA makes the decision that it makes, and vice versa. But there is what's called the symbiotic relationship test, and that is the relationship between the state and the racetrack so intertwined that it implicates due process rights? And the answer to that is yes. A line of cases in New York about that, and particularly because NYRA operates under a franchise from the state and is overseen by an oversight franchise board, that there is a symbiotic relationship. So because of that, a licensee is entitled to notification, but also entitled to due process before they can bar that individual. And then based on that process, NYRA is entitled to make a discretionary business decision, a reasonable discretionary business decision, that to have that individual running at its tracks is detrimental to the business, that it is disruptive to patrons or to the public, it harms the integrity of the sport, and may implicate and have a negative impact on their on the economic you know, soundness of their business. And that's something they have to do. Now, what they did here yesterday, from what it appears on its face, is they followed a Supreme Court case, and I think I referred to this Supreme Court case in my discussion with you last week. It's an old Supreme Court case that goes back to the, I think it was 1973, Barry versus Barchi, which was a New York case involving the harness industry, a challenge by a harness trainer against what was then the New York State Racing and Wagering Board, who had been suspended summarily for a doping violation or an alleged doping violation. And this trainer was not given any due process, nor was he told when he would get his due process. And the Supreme Court in that case said, because of the harm to the sport or the alleged integrity of the sport being implicated in the business, yes, you, Racing and Wagering Board, have the authority to summarily suspend this trainer, but you must give him due process, and you must do it in an expeditious manner. So, and I think I said last week, you rarely see racing commissions summarily suspend a trainer, but they have the right to do so. So there are some people who will argue, well, if this was so important, this was the Kentucky Derby, why didn't the Kentucky Racing Commission summarily suspend Bob Baffert until the investigation was completed, do it on an expedited basis, get the split sample, make your decision, and that would have put everybody in a much better posture. But that didn't happen. The Kentucky Racing Commission has not taken any action yet, and I guess the investigation is still ongoing. So other regulators like the Maryland Racing Commission, New York Gaming Commission, don't have any ability to do anything. So it's left to the racetracks. If they feel the pressure, if they feel the need to respond, since this is the face of the industry, Bob Baffert, I think they felt compelled to do something. And so what they've done, I believe, is similar to what Barry versus Barchi says, and that is they, quote unquote, temporarily suspended Bob, pending the, and all horses trained by him and his personnel, pending completion of the investigation in Kentucky by the Kentucky Racing Commission and resolution of that case by the commission, which I suspect will be done by the time of the dirt, of the Belmont, in which case everybody will now know where this matter stands. If the referee test confirms the positive test, the stewards will give Bob a hearing, and they will issue a ruling, and Bob can appeal that ruling to the Kentucky Racing Commission, and from there, if he gets an adverse decision, he and his owners can appeal it to the through the court system in Kentucky. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But what NYRA has done is it has delivered a message about their view on the situation and the integrity of the sport. But they've done it in a way that indicates, look, we just feel under the circumstances until this is better cleared up, that we're going to take a stand that we're not going to permit you to participate until it's resolved, and then we'll make a final decision as to where things stand.
A couple of things, Alan Foreman with us, and you mentioned the referee sample. One thing that came out last week leading into the weekend, the rapid turnaround of the tests of Medina Spirit Concert Tour and Beautiful Gift as part of the negotiated entry of the three for the Black Eyed Susan and the Preakness. Why is it possible to have those screenings done on an expedited basis repeatedly, three rounds of tests, and then in terms of, you know, the mechanics of, you know, of post-race sampling and split sampling, et cetera, it takes weeks on end, sometimes months.
Yeah, I'm a little bit perplexed by, there was a comment made last week in explaining the process. I forgot who it was, but that referee sample testing can take anywhere from weeks to months. And I'm not familiar with any referee sample taking 6 months, 5 months, 4 months. That shouldn't be acceptable under any situation. With respect to the testing that was conducted last week in order for Bob Baffert and his horses to participate in Preakness weekend, samples were collected. They were overnighted to the labs that agreed to take the sample, and the laboratories agreed to test those samples immediately. And so, I don't know when Bob was given formal notice by the Kentucky Racing Commission of his positive test for betamethasone, but typically a trainer has 48 hours from the time of notification to either elect to have the split sample sent out or not. That split sample sits in a secure refrigerator freezer because there's urine and blood samples that are, I believe they were Churchill Downs. And when the trainer elects to have the positive test, a representative of the commission, and if the trainer wants, a representative of the trainer go to that refrigerator, retrieve the sample, and identify it. That sample is sitting in a secure packaging, and it's inspected, number one, to ensure it's the same sample with the same barcode number, but also that it hasn't been tampered with. It's prepared for shipment in front of the representative, the trainer. It is sealed, and then it's given, whether it's UPS or FedEx, and it's overnighted to the laboratory. That laboratory, it strikes me that whatever laboratory agrees to take it could be instructed to expedite the testing. And maybe that's going on right now. I don't know. I don't even know what lab it went to. But when it gets to that laboratory, they're going to preserve the sample. When you're dealing with a sample that has a quantitative limit on it, you don't want that sample to sit because you don't want to even invoke the possibility of degradation of this sample, because you're talking about quantitative limits. So the sooner it's tested, the better. And I don't know what arrangements have been made by the Kentucky Racing Commission or otherwise. I would like to think that that test is being conducted on an expedited basis, and they will be getting the results fairly quickly, which is why I think that at least the initial resolution of the case will occur before before the Belmont is run. So it'll put NARA in a, depending upon it, it'll be a stewards hearing fairly quickly. And then, you know.
Assume they'll make some sort of a, you know, exception in this thing. I mean, what's your read on what this means?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's been some, there's been discussion in the scientific community about what to do with CBD. And it's, you know, it's not permitted in a horse. It's not permitted for therapeutic purposes or otherwise. But it is ubiquitous now in society. So I just saw that Ron had the positive. You know, I don't know that Ron's ever had a positive test before this. So let's this is one of those where you have to put in context. And when you're dealing with CBD oil, when you're dealing with cocaine, when you're dealing with some of these drugs that are ubiquitous in society, everyone concedes and everyone knows that the possibility of contamination, that is transfer from a human to the horse that could generate a positive test, is very high. And the rules recognize that. And the rules take that into consideration. So, you know, when Ron has a positive test, he will go through the regulatory process, and there will be substantial mitigating factors in his case, I can assure you, both his own record and the possibility of contamination and otherwise. I'll leave that for his lawyers to argue, but that's a different situation than what we're dealing with here.
Part of the contamination conversation that I saw bubbling out you know, publicly yesterday with this, frankly, I found somewhat amusing because, you know, the people who, you know, have scoffed generally when the concept of a contamination comes up, right away were saying, well, this has got to be a contamination. So it's like, oh, okay, so it's when it's someone you perceive, as beyond reproach, it's the contaminations can happen, but otherwise,
well,
they can't.
Yeah. Look, I don't think it's unfair to look at. I'll never forget. I mean, one of the toughest cases I ever handled when I was doing these was Charlie Hadry, who trained for the Janney family. Okay, Charlie was one of the most widely respected Hay, Oats, and Water trainers in Maryland. He was a great horseman, and Charlie had one of his horses that tested positive for cocaine. And everybody was laughing. Charlie Hadry, cocaine? We investigated, and it was determined that his foreman was had a drug issue, crack cocaine, you know, whatever. And they found... they actually found the substance on the tongue tie when they went into the barn. We took the tongue tie. We took anything the horse might have been associated with, and the tongue tie tested positive, brought the foreman in and drug tested him and realized that this was a clear case of contamination. And the Charlie had never had any kind of a disciplinary action against him in 40 years of training. And the racing commission suspended him for 15 days. And there was just general outrage in the community about that. And the Baltimore Sun even did an editorial on it that, regulators, you can do better than this. So, you can look at individuals when they get these kinds of tests and say, no way. Not the way they run their barns, not their longstanding reputation and otherwise. But when you talk about contamination, you have to look at the substance, because contamination is argued far too often. And it's not plausible in many situations, because some of the substances that are complained about as possibility of contamination, you'd have to give a truckload of the drug to the horse in order to generate a positive test if it's by contamination. But with cocaine and some of these human drugs, if the horse licks the finger of a drug user who's had crack cocaine in his pocket, that will be enough to generate a positive test. So you have to look at each situation on its face and with its own peculiarities.
Well, and similarly, explain methocarbamol.
So methocarbamol is another one of these. They're considered to be relatively innocuous. It's a muscle relaxant, and it's very commonly used in the business. And it generated a substantially litigated case involving Graham Motion in Kentucky, and the application of the rules in Kentucky. You know, the testing limits, the sensitivity of the testing limits, withdrawal times, and the like. And you know, there was a time in Kentucky where a methocarbamol positive could result in disciplinary action against the trainer, but no disqualification of the horse.
Right.
And there was a case involving a very prominent breeder owner in a stakes race in Kentucky, and the Kentucky Racing Commission determined in that case not to disqualify the horse, which created an outrage. You know, the kind of situations we have here. In one state, it's a disqualification. In another state, it's not. And those who are high on top, who were busy telling everybody about what we're doing wrong with the regulation of medication, and then one of their own gets a positive and doesn't get disqualified. It's why these questions continually perk. And it's why there is optimism that when the HISA framework is put together, there will be one set of rules, application of one set of rules. You're still going to be taking into consideration mitigating circumstances, aggravating circumstances, but the discretion to disqualify or not disqualify, I think that will go out the window. And I think in the world we're in today, that people are going to demand that if a horse is participating with a drug in its system that's prohibited, whether it's therapeutic or not, it's going to require a disqualification. It's just, you know, you get this debate about, well, why in that case was the horse not disqualified? And in this case, it is. And I think there's less and less desire among those who are going to be regulating the sport to have to pick and choose.
Well, very fair. And, you know, the less often that, you know, the headlines are suggesting, you know, that everything. You and I have discussed this forever. You know, everything that involves a positive is construed as, you know, as doping, and the public is just, you know, oblivious. And you know, this case is certainly, you know, this week and a half is a perfect example of this. I mean, it's hard enough,
Steve.
It's hard enough, Alan, to explain it to, you know, people that are involved in the sport, let alone, you know, the general public.
I mean, I've been on your show now, what, four times in the past 2 weeks?
Yes.
And I'm trying to explain things to people, and, you know, the reaction's been pretty good that, you know, thanks, you know, and I understand this better. We don't have anybody in the sport who gets out in front of the public and can do that. I'm not talking about me. I'm just saying that's
right.
One of our biggest problems. Who's speaking for the sport? Who's explaining this? Who is helping the public to understand what's going on there? Nobody. So you've got, you know, one group doing this and one group doing that, and the media doing its thing. We have no ability to stand up in front of the public and say, folks, this is how it works. This is how it's happening. This is what's going on. And I, you know, I'd like to think that in the area of medication and safety and welfare, that through HISA, that's what's going to happen. And I think people will have confidence in that rather than hearing from differing people in differing groups. We look dysfunctional.
That's fair. And even people who have been, you know, very supportive are frustrated and at wit's end a little bit, given, you know, especially a day like yesterday where it was, you know, it was a constant assault on the senses, essentially. Let's wrap up with something very upbeat, and that was two really fun days at Old Hilltop.
With all the negative publicity and all that's going on, the handle was through the roof on both days. And with an attendance of somewhere between 10 and 20,000. It's the first time we've been over $100 million, $112 million, whatever. It was astounding. And so there is a public appetite for horse racing. People love it. They love to wager on it. Anybody who watched Friday and Saturday's cards saw great, terrific racing. It was racing at its best. And there is an appetite for that. We've just got to, we've got to get to a place where, the people in the business who I deal with right now are just embarrassed. And they're sad because they deserve better than what's going on. They work too hard. The sport is too, it really is a great sport. And they just feel like they're being sullied by all of this. And we've got to, we're going to have to work our way out of it. But it's encouraging when you see the kind of racing and the handle numbers. That was really very pleasantly surprising.
It was two terrific days, and the one thing that I wonder, I've kind of wrote some things on social media accounts, whether next May, there's potential that the building as we know it is partly gone or fully gone too. I mean, this may have been the last gathering. In the format we're so familiar with, people of a certain age.
I don't think Pimlico grandstand and facilities will come down between now and next May. I think that you will definitely see the prototype of what will be there. I think you'll see it for Laurel also. What they will have to coordinate is, because we're dealing with both Pimlico and Laurel, and at least the sense when we did the concept plan and the sense now is that you've got to get Laurel done, at least the backstretch and the racing surfaces first, because racing is going to be consolidated at Laurel to facilitate not only the construction of the new Pimlico, but, once it's done, what Pimlico will be. So it's not inconceivable that the shovels will go into ground at Pimlico next year, as I said on several shows and whatever. The Preakness will always be run at Pimlico, even during construction. Okay, it will never leave Pimlico, and that was a foundational understanding when we started, even the concept plan and the negotiations over the resolution of the Baltimore City litigation against the Stronach Group to eminent domain, the Preakness in Pimlico. It's foundational, okay? Sometime between either 22 and 23 or 23 and 24, the racing surfaces at Pimlico have to be torn up because they're going to rotate the track 30 degrees to allow for the development quadrants that will surround the property. So I can't tell you which it's going to be. We're procuring the construction firm right now for Pimlico. Then we have to do the procurement for all of Laurel. And once that's done, there is a timeline that at least a temporary timeline that's been set in motion, and most of that deals with the design team right now. But we'll have a better idea, I think, as we go into the fall, what the timeline will be, and I'll be able much more informed and be able to help everyone with understanding how this is going to progress. There was a reporter on WBAL radio this week that said that Pimlico is going to start coming down the day after the Preakness, and that caused all kinds of hullabaloo. It's not the case. They're in the shovel going into the ground. We're nowhere near that yet.
I'm glad you addressed that, because there had been some murmurs that about the barns and about the old the condemned end of the, or the unused end of the building. So I appreciate that.
I wouldn't rule anything out, but without a construction firm in place and without design elements completed, and there's tremendous infrastructure work that needs to be done. The infrastructure is gone. The building doesn't sit on a foundation. There's so much to consider, and then for a period of time, horses may have to be housed at Pimlico while the Laurel work is being done. Are you going to want to demolish and do construction while the horses are on the property, because they're going to be located in temporary stables right where that building is. So it doesn't strike me as feasible, but I'm not the expert. We did a concept plan, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily had it right with it. And then the transition is the key to all of this. It's what the horsemen are concerned about. Everybody's concerned about. How are you gonna? There's no playbook for this, Steve. Nobody's ever done this before. I don't think anybody will ever do it again. So it's one thing to build one racetrack or one grandstand, but you're doing two facilities completely. That's why I'm glad the Stadium Authority is overseeing it, because if anybody's capable of figuring this out, it's them.
Well, the last modernization renovation project of this kind was in New York in the 60s when Belmont and Aqueduct were alternately rebuilt.
And you will see a rebuild of Belmont, without question. But again, that's one facility. I mean, we've got to coordinate Maryland racing, and it's not going to be easy, and it's going to be disruptive. But you're going to have to go through a little bit of pain to get to the future. I say to people, you're going to the future. This will cement Maryland racing for the next 30 years, and that's a pretty good trade-off.
No doubt. No doubt. Alan Forman, as always, just invaluable. And I said before you joined us, you probably didn't hear, I can't remember a year where the guest of the year was determined by May, but it's congratulations.
Steve, I think you need less of me and more of racing. We know this stuff needs to go away. People are getting tired of it.
that's a good summation. Three good races to get the match series going, and in fact, Pimlico and Laurel will be hosting the next set, and Delaware soon, and underway. Well done.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you.
Alan Forman, everybody. There you go. Let's stay here, Case, and what we'll do is we'll do two halves this morning. Jessica Martini standing by. Let's get Jessica in here, and we'll talk about what went on at Timonium yesterday. It's an all Maryland special to get started today, and certainly the sale action, which is about day two, about an hour away, seemed like a very varied owner's bench yesterday. So I did not get a chance to dig through and read all the fun backstories about the breeders and the consigners and the buyers. So we're going to rely on Jess for that. Afterward, in fact, we'll take the break at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back, and Jonathan Hardoon is going to join us. And so many of you that are Sheetz users, Rag is in Sheetz. You know Hardoon, and you appreciate what he and the staff from Rag is in, both pre and post Len, the team has brought and worked hard to help people improve not just their handicapping, but their management of their stable. Certainly, when it comes to buying and selling horses privately or claiming horses. I mean, that's as big a part of the Sheetz story, both the origin of what Len Ragazin did. As well as what Jerry Brown has done with Thoroughgraph, and we're looking forward to. I reminded John Hardoon that he was on the show once years and years ago, and I've got a funny. I mean, my connection is more on the Thoroughgraph side, because when we were running the barbecue at Saratoga, people kept coming up to the barbecue stand. Fairly early on Saturday mornings, like at 9:30, as people were getting settled in and they had filled in at their picnic tables, and they would say, "Is this where the Sheetz seminar is?" And I at first I said, I have no idea. And no, it's not. Well, it's supposed to be at the barbecue. I said, well, this is Carolina barbecue. I said, but we don't. So after about a year of that, after one summer of it, I knew Jerry Brown a little bit at Thurgraph, and I reached out to Jerry that winter, and I said, Jerry, and I found out eventually that Ragazin, that they were having seminars at the barbecue area back by the Big Red Spring. And so I reached out to Jerry that winter. I wrote him an email, said, you know, introduced myself to him again, and said, you know, I've got this barbecue stand, and people keep coming. I said, why don't you do a Thurgraph seminar? And that started the Thurgraph seminars at Saratoga, which have been going on almost 20 years since. So I'm sort of Ragazin adjacent when it comes to sheet methodology, but in absolute awe and have just tremendous respect for what Len Ragazin created. With Julie Fink and the Speed Boys, and I mean in the history of speed figures and you know, figuring out performance numbers, there with Beyer and you know, the biggest names, Pittsburgh Phil. I mean, all the groundbreakers. Jessica Martini joins us now, and Jess, after an hour of listening to racing commissions and legal wranglings, everybody's in the mood for a martini. Good morning.
Is everybody still awake?
they're awake. They hang on this stuff, and I think it's so important just for people to understand these mechanisms. I mean, it's in a lot of ways, Jess, it's not dissimilar from the workings in and around the breeding side of the business, and then the, you know, the development and the sales end. I mean, the sales has its own, you know, methodologies and you know, governing principles and mechanics, you know, from the repository to, you know, to the terms of sale and, you know, stand and nurse. And, you know, there's a lot of...
A lot of nitty-gritty, yeah.
You bet. Right. You bet. Well, there's also a limited number of two-year-olds in training for sale. And we got one day here, and then we're going to have 3 days in June at OBS. And there's been demand. Talk about day one yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's been a continuation of what we saw at OBS April with just a strong demand throughout the marketplace, not just at the top, but throughout, a deep buying bench. I think when Padgett Bennett came out yesterday, the director of sales at the Mid-Atlantic sale, to do her post-sale press conference, she used the word "I'm thrilled" about four or five times. So they couldn't be more pleased with what happened yesterday, just a strong sale throughout, and hoping for that to continue today. And as you said, we're running out of sales, so there's almost I don't want to say desperation, but like people know, okay, if I want to get a two-year-old, I got to do it now. So there's a lot of competition.
No, exactly. And I also, you know, sensed, and I based the opinion on Gary Young when Gary came from OBS April, and I said, "How'd you do?" This was at, you know, we were assembled in at Churchill already, and he said, "I got shut out." And I said, holy cow.
He's got a lot behind him, but yeah. he's getting shut out.
So,
lots of other people are getting shut out too.
And, you know, that means that you then turn to a sale like this, you know, as the next opportunity. And, you know, this has always been, for a long time, it was thought of as a great bargain hunter sale. There isn't necessarily the same bargain mentality as much as, you know, there's just a standing belief that you can get a nice horse here at Timonium, and you know, people are probably paying more than they used to, you know, a decade ago.
Yeah, I think a couple things about this sale really stand out, and it's grown over the last 6 or 7 years. to the point where I think this is the sixth year in a row they've had a $1 million sale. But yeah, obviously the geography of the Timonium sale is awesome for a sale. There's so many racetracks within driving distance, so it attracts a huge number of trainers, more trainers than you would see at OBS or anything. And then another thing is that people always talk about the dirt track here.
Yes.
At OBS with the all-weather track, it's hard to separate the horses. But here, when the horses are working on the dirt track, it separates them. So the buyers have more confidence that what they think they're buying is what they're getting.
You also, you know, you talk about the region, you know, the proximity. But part of it is also the catalog, you know, with 35, you know, this is before outs, but, you know, 35 Maryland breds and you know, Maryland sires that, you know, end up dropping elsewhere in the region. Looks like there's about 40-plus Pennsylvania breds, about 70 New York breds. So, you know, you get that appeal as well. And these are in the region. You get two-year-olds that end up being Virginia certified. They get Delaware certified as well. So there's real appeal to, you know, latching on to these horses.
Sure, there's something for everyone. I know we say that a bunch of times, but I think that's really true at this sale.
Let's take a look at what went on yesterday, and certainly one thing that is becoming, you know, fairly commonplace, seven-figure purchases by West Point. And here's the Quality Road late in the afternoon, hip 211, that fetches $1.5 million.
Yeah, I think a lot of people had this one. We all kind of knew this one was going to be the highlight of the day. And shortly before he came in the ring, Amr Zaiden, you know, strode in and he looked all confident. And he was bidding from the seats with Gary Young. And Terry Finley was standing off just a few rows behind him. And I think Amr Zaiden looked a little surprised that he still had company with West Point answering every bid that he made. So it was very interesting, but Terry Finley said after he signed the ticket that he had a partner on the horse, a new partner for West Point, and that gave him that extra capital to pursue this horse.
This is a colt out of the Stormcat mare, Stormy Welcome, and Third Dam jumps off the page, of course, in here, Weekend Surprise, who is about as important in recent, you know, in recent Blue Hen mythology as any mare in the last, you know, 40-50 years. You know, it's funny, just seeing her in here makes me, I don't know, it kind of makes me think that, you know, this would be even more valuable as a filly.
Yeah, probably. He was bred by John Clay's Alpha Delta Stables, and they usually actually sell their foals as yearlings, but this one they said was a little backwards, so they decided to wait. And that really worked out for them yesterday. And in addition to the pedigree, he had a really strong 10 flat work last week at the Undertech show.
Well, and you stressed the dirt track and the way it separated, and I was there for a portion of the Breeze show the other day. Went over after the show and then had nice lunch with Ferris Allen and Woodbury Payne. And it was really remarkable what a spread. There was a 10 and 10 and 3, 10 and 2, up to 11. The ones that were breezing a quarter, they were all over the board. I mean, there was a real difference in terms of the times. And you could see, you could really, even the ones that let's say went in, you know, 10 and 2, 10 and 3, some of them, you know, were just really getting going, and then they on the gallop out, and, you know, there's professional clockers that are watching and advising, you know, outfits about, you know, what the breeze meant beyond just the time. And it's a point well made that the dirt track is very different than the synthetic at OBS. Not that that's a negative, but there is certain aspects to it that really, you know, spread out the field, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure, they're positives. I mean, I know they talk about OBS if they have a big rainstorm come through that the track, they can keep it consistent. So obviously there's some positives to both sides of it. And talking about the works from last week, I think people, not just the time, but people are really interested in how they do it and how they look on the video. And the gallop out has become even more important in recent years.
After the Quality Road, well, there was another colt the second highest, 700,000. And this a Malibu Moon, another that Eddie Woods consigned. This was hip 164. What do we know about Elliott and McElroy?
Alex Elliott and Ben McElroy, they team up. They're a pair of both track agents. They team up both here and in Europe. They've been busy working, and they declined to say who they were buying for, but the horse will be trained for Simon Callahan, and they said it was for a partnership. So that was a nice pinhook for Bill Harrigan, who Eddie Woods was selling that horse for. He had RNA'd last year at Keeneland, I think, for 125, and Bill Harrigan was able to buy him privately after the sale.
Happened to have had a text exchange as Harrigan was driving down, in fact, to Florida the other day, and does such a great job. So congratulations to Bill on that. And you know, it's also a nice sale for Malibu Moon.
Yeah, there were a couple of stallions that had good sales. I was really actually impressed with how the Classic Empires have sold. They'll talk about First Crop Sires a lot, and he had a very good sale yesterday. His top filly was a $550,000 purchase for the Robert and Luana Lou. I think he had a good sale, and he has got a couple coming up today, too, that should be interesting to watch for.
That Classic Empire was a filly that Chester and Mary Broman. Tell you what, for an outfit that's supposedly getting out of the business, they continue to rack up terrific sales.
I'd like my estate planning to look like this.
Right? I mean, they've had so many nice successes the last couple of years.
Yeah, Becky, we talked to Becky Thomas, who obviously consigned for the Bermans yesterday, and she said when they started out a few years ago and they had that $2 million cap it at OBS yep. March, they were being very aggressive in their estate planning, but now they've kind of scaled it back a little bit, and they're going to be choosing their spots and maybe race a couple as well, so a little change for them.
Who, let's see, this was, right, you mentioned Sequel, you mentioned Becky Thomas. Then we skipped down. There were two in the $400,000 range. Kerry Radcliffe buying for Sheila Rosenblum. Here's a $460,000 Munnings colt that Kieran Dunn, who's had a tremendous year. Kieran Dunn has been lighting it up, you know, since February. This is a Pennsylvania bred.
It's a Pennsylvania bred, and he actually, when I talked to Kieran before the sale, had said that that's the reason they targeted him for the sale, because, you know, closer to the region where he would be yeah. more valuable. But I don't think with that 10 flat work, I don't think the region even mattered to Kerry Radcliffe or to Sheila Rosenblum. But that was another great pinhook for Kieran. He bought that horse for $55,000 last year and sold it for $460,000 yesterday.
How about that? And by the way, the low, the New York bred, I'm guessing Todd?
Yes. The Classic okay. Empire, yes, going to Todd Pletcher.
And what is, you know, Sheila Rosenblum, what's, she's moved some horses around of late. What's her plan?
She said this one will go to Steve Asmussen.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Joe Besseker was plenty active yesterday, and top fetch was $425,000 for the Gormley colt. And Gormley's had a very good winter, Jess. I mean, it has sold some big six-figure items as the winter's gone on.
I was impressed by a lot of the Gormleys I saw on the track last week. I think for a $5,000 stallion, he's looking like value to me. But yeah, Joseph Besseker was very busy. Of course, he was famous for a few years ago dispersing all his stock in the Timonium sales ring, I think, in the December sale. But obviously didn't take, and he's back in a big way. I think he signed for 13 horses yesterday. And this was obviously way and above higher than he would normally spend, but he said he had some partners on the horse.
How about that? That's it. Somebody, you know, when just when you thought you were out, they drag you back in. You can't, right? You can't get away. You can't get away clean.
No, he tried. He tried his best.
Pretty funny. I'm just kind of thumbing down now, and I'm just looking for the first. I'm just out of curiosity more than anything else, who the highest priced horse was that went a quarter of a mile. And here it is, a unified colt that Marshall Silverman offered and Mike McCarty bought for $150. And that's the first. Yeah, and there was a very nice, I thought there looked like there was a very nice middle yesterday, Jess, from, you know, call it 100,000 to 300,000. Nice thickening in there in the middle.
Yeah, that's great to see. And I think that's kind of a shuffle down from the top that people are getting shut out. And they're instead of walking away, they're going to that next level down and trying to find value there.
Anything else catch your eye? You know, of course, the hip distribution will, you know, they'll be easier to make some summaries after tomorrow. And I have not looked again at the catalog, you know, for day two. But anything we should be watching for?
I think the standout today might be the Tappet filly with Demeric Sales. She's out of the Alcibiades winner Gomo. And it's just a classy looking filly. She RNA'd at the Gulfstream Sale for 475 and came here and worked 10-1 last week and looks like a really nice prospect.
Nice. And I'm just doing my alphabetized thumbing, and you know who sold well again yesterday? We'll see how many more go today. The American Freedoms feels like a story to watch. 65, 80, 200 yesterday, and then one inexpensive one for 7,000. But the American Freedoms have been beating the drum pretty much all two-year-old season.
Yeah, he seems like he's on the cusp of really breaking out. I know that you spoke of the $200,000 one that was purchased by Kevin McCathen for $100,000 last year, so a nice pinhook score for him.
Who else among the I didn't look at the list of I've got the pinhook sheet from TDN. I've got it printed out, but I didn't get a chance to, with everything else going on, I didn't get a chance to see who else scored out.
Steve Venosa had a nice score with the Keen Ice colt that he bought for $57,000 at the Fasig October sale last year and sold yesterday for $225,000. So that was a nice score for Steve, who's had another good spring for him. And Al Pike had a gun runner that he bought for $45,000 in last year and sold for $225,000 yesterday. So some first crop success stories for those guys too.
Nice. Well, and I'm going to mention one good feature. I'm looking forward maybe tomorrow or Thursday having Josh Pons on. There was a divining rod yesterday that Randy Morse bought for $135,000. And I saw Divining Rod, and actually one of his babies that Mike Trombetta and Marie bred, and was gorgeous, just gorgeous in terms of stamping, you know, his foals. And Divining Rod feels like a kind of a story to watch.
Yeah, and there was Frisian Fires had some success in the Timonium Sales Ring, and he had a horse sell for $130,000 yesterday too. It's another regional sire to look for.
Well, and then if it's not just the stallions at between Malibu Moon and Mosler and Divining Rod and Frisian Fire, there's also the $60 winner that Country Life had on Friday in the nightcap, if you were paying attention. Racing partnership. Yeah. Jess, I appreciate it. And looking forward, they're about a half an hour from getting started. So get some good stories, and we'll look forward to reading them later in TDN.
Great. Thanks, Steve.
I appreciate it. Jess Martini, TDN. You should be following and read her stories, her and all the Bloodstock staff at TDN. They dig up some of the fun backstories. We're exactly 90 minutes in and 90 to come. We'll take a break here, probably our only of the morning. And when we come back, Jonathan Hardoon, joins us, and Jonathan will pay tribute, appropriate tribute, to the late Len Friedman, 92, and Ragazin, not Len Friedman, Len Ragazin, and we'll have Len Friedman tomorrow, but Len Ragazin, who really brought another wrinkle to handicapping and to the evaluation of bloodstock, and you know, help change the game in another way, brought a whole new way to make decisions when it came to prospects or claim, you know, possible claims. King Leatherbury's whole career, his terrific career, was based on sheet methodology. He was the first to just claim horses without worrying about, you know, what they looked like physically. It really, really was a seismic shift. Second half at the races, we're also going to visit with John Fradkin and talk about Rombauer. Wonderful, really encouraging story about, you know, those that are of a certain size in the game and trying. And we'll talk about the decisions to go to Twirling Candy, and the result was Rombauer. Who else? Popo in here later. We'll recap Form to Win, and we'll also look at the Canterbury card tonight as well. 6:10 Eastern Time, first post, as the season gets started in Shakopee. Back after this, Jonathan Hardoon.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Sirius XM Sports presents